of the Social Contract by Jean-Jacques Rousseau, an Adult Brain audiobook production, read by Graham Dunlop.
Foreword. This little treatise is extracted from a more extended work which was undertaken at another time, without having consulted my capacities, and long since abandoned. Of the various fragments that might have been taken from what was done, this is the most considerable and appears to me the least unworthy to be offered to the public. The rest no longer exists. Book 1. I wish to inquire whether, in the civil order, it is possible to have some legitimate and sure rule of administration, taking men as they are and the laws as they can be. In this inquiry, I shall always try to unite what right permits with what interest prescribes, so that justice and utility are in no way divided. I embark upon the task without proving the importance of my subject. Someone will ask me if I am a prince or a legislator in order to write on politics. I answer no, and that is why I am writing on politics. If I were a prince or a legislator, I would not waste my time saying what is necessary to do. I would do it or keep silent. Born a citizen of a free state and a member of the sovereign, whatever feeble influence my voice could have in public affairs, the right to vote suffices to impose upon me the duty to instruct myself in them. Happy am I whenever I meditate on governments, always to find in my inquiries new reasons to love that of my country. Chapter 1. The subject of the first book. Man was born free, but everywhere he is in chains. Whoever thinks himself the master of others is nevertheless more a slave than they. How did this change come about? I do not know. What can render it legitimate? I think I can resolve this question. If I were to consider only force and the effect derived from it, I would say, as long as a people is constrained to obey and obeys, it does well. As soon as it can shake off the yoke and succeeds, it does even better. Because recovering its liberty by the same right that stole it away, either a people is justified in taking freedom back, or there was no justification to derive a people of it. But the social order is a sacred right which serves as a basis of all the others. However, this right does not come from nature. It is therefore founded on conventions. The problem is to know what are these conventions. Before going on to that, I must establish what I have just asserted. Chapter 2. Of the First Societies. The most ancient of all societies and the only natural one is the family. Yet children remain tied to the father only as long as they need him for their preservation. As soon as this need ceases, the natural tie is dissolved. Children, released from the obedience that they owe the father, and he released from the cares owed the children, they all return equally to independence. If they continue to stay united, it is no longer naturally, it is voluntarily, and the family itself is maintained only by convention. This common freedom is a consequence of the nature of man. His first law is to watch over his own preservation. His first cares are those that he owes to himself. And as soon as he reaches the age of reason, he alone, being judge of the proper means to preserve himself, becomes thereby his own master. The family, therefore, may be called the first model of political societies. The ruler is the image of the father. The people is the image of the children. And all, being born equal and free, alienate their freedom only for their utility. The only difference is that in the family the love of the father for his children compensates him for the cares that he renders them, while in the state the pleasure of commanding takes the place of this love, which the ruler does not have for his people. Grotius denies that all human power is established for the benefit of those who are governed. He cites slavery as an example. His most characteristic way of reasoning is to establish right by fact. One could use a more consistent method, but not one more favorable to tyrants. Note:
learned inquiries into public right are often only the history of ancient abuses, and one becomes improperly stubborn when one troubles oneself to study them too hard. Treatise on the Interests of France with Her Neighbors, MLM, Da. This is precisely what Grotius did.
It is then doubtful, according to Grotius, whether mankind belongs to 100 men or whether this 100 men belong to mankind. And he appears throughout his book to lean to the first of these opinions. This is also the sentiment of Hobbes. Thus we see the human species divided into herds of cattle, each with its ruler, who protects it in order to devour it. As a shepherd has a superior nature to that of his herd, so the shepherds of men, their rulers, also have a superior nature to that of their people. The Emperor Caligula, reasoning from this analogy, readily concluded, according to the report of Philo, that kings were gods or that peoples were beasts. The reasoning of this Caligula coincides with that of Hobbes and Grotius. Aristotle, before them all, had also said that men are not naturally equal, but that some are born for slavery and others for domination. Aristotle was correct, but he took the effect for the cause. Any man born in slavery is born for slavery, nothing is more certain. Slaves lose everything in their chains, even the desire to escape from them. They love their servitude, as the companions of Ulysses loved their brutish condition. Note:
see a little treatise by Plutarch titled That Animals Use Reason.
If, then, there are slaves by nature, it is because there have been slaves against nature. Force made the first slaves. Their cowardice has perpetuated their slavery. I have said nothing of the King Adam, nor of the Emperor Noah, father of the 3 great monarchs who divided the universe among themselves, as did the children of Saturn, whom some have thought to recognize in them. I hope some may be grateful to me for this moderation, for having descended directly from one of these princes, and perhaps from the oldest branch. How do I know but what on the verification of titles I might find myself the legitimate king of mankind? In any case, one cannot deny that Adam was sovereign of the world, as was Robinson of his island, as long as he was the only inhabitant. And what was convenient in this empire was that the monarch, secure on his throne, had to fear neither rebellion, nor wars, nor conspirators. Chapter 3 of The Right of the Strongest. The strongest is never strong enough, always, to be the master, unless he transforms his force into right and obedience into duty. Hence the right of the strongest. Right, apparently meant ironically, but actually established as principle. But will we never have an explanation of this word? Force is a physical power. I do not see what morality can result from its effects. To yield to force is an act of necessity, not of will. At most, it is an act of prudence. In what sense can it be a duty? Let us suppose for a moment that the so-called right exists. I say that it results only in inexplicable nonsense. For as soon as it is force that makes right, the effect changes with the cause. Every force that overcomes the first succeeds to its right. As soon as one can disobey with impunity, one does so legitimately, and since the strongest is always correct, it is only a question of acting in such a way that one may be the strongest. But what kind of right is it that perishes when force ceases? If it is necessary to obey by force, one does not need to obey by duty. And if one is not forced to obey, one is no longer obligated. Therefore, this word right adds nothing to force. It does not mean anything here. Obey power. If this means yield to force, the precept is good but superfluous. I answer that it will never be violated. All power comes from God, I avow. But so does all disease. Is that to say that it is forbidden to call a doctor, A brigand surprises me in a recess of a forest. Not only is it necessary by force to give my purse, but even if I could withhold it, am I obligated in conscience to give it? After all, the pistol he holds is also a power. Let us agree, then, that force does not make right, and that one is only obligated to obey legitimate powers. Thus, my first question always returns. Chapter 4 of Slavery. Since no man has a natural authority over his fellow, and since force produces no right, what remains are conventions as the basis of all legitimate authority among men. If an individual, says Grotius, can alienate his freedom and make himself the slave of a master, why could not a whole people alienate its freedom and make itself subject to a king? There are many equivocal words here that would need explanation, but let us confine ourselves to the word alienate. To alienate is to give or sell. Now, a man who makes himself the slave of another does not give himself, he sells himself, at the very least, for his subsistence. But a people, for what does it sell itself? Far from furnishing his subjects their subsistence, a king gets his own only from them. And according to Rabelais, a king does not live on little. Do subjects then give their persons on the condition that their goods also be taken? I do not see what is left them to preserve. It will be said that the despot assures his subjects civil tranquility. Very well, but what do they gain if the wars that his ambition brings upon them, if his insatiable avidity, if the harassments of his ministers desolate them more than would their own dissensions? What do they gain if this tranquility itself is one of their miseries? One also lives tranquilly in dungeons. Is that enough to be well off there? The Greeks imprisoned in the cave of the Cyclops live there tranquilly, awaiting their turn to be devoured. To say that a man gives himself gratuitously is to say a thing absurd and inconceivable. Such an act is illegitimate and null, if only because he who does it is not in his right mind. To say the same thing of a whole people is to suppose a people of madmen. Madness does not make right. Even if each man could alienate himself, he could not alienate his children. They are born men and free. Their freedom belongs to them, and no one but themselves has a right to dispose of it. Before they are of the age of reason, the father can lay down the conditions for their preservation, for their well-being. But he cannot give them away irrevocably and without condition, because such a gift is contrary to the ends of nature and exceeds the rights of paternity. So, for an arbitrary government to be legitimate, it would be necessary that each generation of people be able to accept or reject the master. But then this government would no longer be arbitrary. To renounce one's freedom is to renounce what makes one a man, to renounce the rights of humanity as well as its duties. There is no possible compensation for someone who renounces everything. Such a renunciation is incompatible with the nature of man, and to remove all freedom from his will is to remove all morality from his actions. Finally, it is an empty and contradictory convention that lays down on one side an absolute authority, and on the other an obedience without limit. Is it not clear that one is not obligated at all to someone from whom one has the right to exact everything? And does not this condition alone, without equivalent, without exchange, nullify the act? For what right can my slave have against me, since all that he has belongs to me? And if his right is mine, to speak of this right of mine against myself is senseless. Grotius and the others derive from war another origin of the so-called right of slavery. The victor having, according to them, the right to kill the vanquished, the latter can buy back his life at the price of his freedom, a convention all the more legitimate in that it profits both parties. But it is clear that this so-called right to kill the vanquished does not result in any manner from the state of war. Men, living in their primitive independence, have not among themselves constant enough relations to constitute either the state of peace or the state of war. From this alone, they are not at all naturally enemies. It is the relation of things and not of men that constitutes war. And the state of war cannot be born from simple and personal relations, but only from property relations. Private war, or war between one man and another, cannot exist in the state of nature, where there is no fixed property, or in the social state, where everything is under the authority of the laws. Individual combats, duels, and encounters are acts which do not constitute a state. And as for private wars, authorized by the establishments of Louis IX, King of France, and suspended by the peace of God, these are abuses of feudal government, an absurd system, if ever there was one, and contrary to the principles of natural right and to any good polity. War, then, is not a relation between man and man, but a relation between state and state, in which individuals are enemies only accidentally. Not as men, nor even as citizens, but as soldiers. Not as members of the fatherland, but as its defenders. Note:
the Romans, who understood best and respected the right of war more than any nation on earth, carried their scruples in this regard so far that a citizen was not permitted to serve as volunteer without engaging himself expressly against the enemy. And against a specifically named enemy. A legion, having been reformed, in which Cato the Younger saw his first service under Popillus. Cato the Elder wrote Popillus that if he wished his son to continue to serve under him, he must administer a new military oath to him, because the first having been annulled, he could no longer bear arms against the enemy. And the same Cato wrote his son to take care not to go into combat until he had taken a new oath. I know the examples of the siege of Clusium and other particular facts may be used against me, but I cite the laws, the practices. The Romans are those who least often transgress their laws, and they are alone in having such noble laws.
Finally, each state can have for enemies only other states, not men. Because between things of different natures there can be no true relation. This principle also conforms to the established maxims of all times and to the constant practice of all civilized peoples. Declarations of war are not so much announcements to powers as to their subjects. The foreigner, whether king, individual, or people, who steals, kills, or detains the subjects without declaring war on a prince is not an enemy. He is a brigand. Even in open war, a just prince in an enemy land properly seizes all that belongs to the public, but he respects the person and the goods of individuals. He respects the rights upon which his own are founded. The end of war being the destruction of the enemy state, one has a right to kill its defenders as long as they bear arms. But as soon as they lay them down and surrender, ceasing to be enemies or instruments of the enemy, they again become simply men. And one no longer has any right to their life. Sometimes it is possible to kill the state without killing a single one of its members, but war gives no right that is not necessary to its end. These principles are not those of Grotius. They are not based on the authority of poets, but they derive from the nature of things and are based on reason. In regard to the right of conquest, it has no other basis than the law of the strongest. If war does not give the victor the right to massacre the vanquished peoples, this right which he does not have cannot serve as a basis of that to enslave them. One has the right to kill the enemy only when one cannot enslave him. The right to enslave him does not come from the right to kill him. It is therefore an iniquitous exchange to make him buy with his freedom his life over which one has no right. In establishing the right of life and death upon the right of slavery, and the right of slavery upon the right of life and death, is it not clear that one falls into a vicious circle? Even assuming this terrible right to kill everyone, I say that a slave made in war or a conquered people is not bound in any way to its master, except to obey him as long as forced to do so. In taking an equivalent for the lives of the enslaved or conquered, the victor has not done them a favor. Instead of killing them without profit, he has killed them usefully. Far from his acquiring any further authority over them in addition to force, The state of war subsists between them as before. Their very relation is the effect of it. And the practice of the right of war does not suppose a peace treaty. They have made a convention. Granted, but this convention, far from destroying the state of war, supposes its continuation. Thus, in whatever way one looks at things, the right of slavery is null, not only because it is illegitimate, but because it is absurd and signifies nothing. These words, slavery and right, are contradictory. They are mutually exclusive. Between a man and another man, or between a man and a people, this statement is equally senseless. I make a convention with you, one wholly at your expense and wholly to my profit, one that I will observe as long as it pleases me, and one that you will observe as long as it pleases me. Chapter 5. That it is always necessary to go back to a first convention. Even if I granted all that I have hitherto refuted, the champions of despotism would be no better off. There will always be a great difference between subduing a multitude and ruling a society. If dispersed men, however numerous they might be, were successively enslaved by one man, I see only there a master and some slaves. I do not see a people and its ruler. Perhaps if one wishes, this is an aggregation but not an association. There is here neither public good nor body politic. This man, if he had enslaved half the world, is still only an individual. His interest, separated from that of the others, is always only a private interest. If this same man were to perish, his empire after him remains dispersed and without connection, as an oak dissolves and falls into a heap of ashes after fire has consumed it. A people, says Grotius, can give itself to a king. According to Grotius, a people is therefore a people before giving itself to a king. This gift itself is a civil act. It assumes public deliberation. Therefore, before examining the act by which a people elects a king, it would be good to examine the act by which a people is a people. For this act, necessarily being prior to the other, is the true foundation of the society. Indeed, if there were no prior convention, where, unless the election were unanimous, would be the obligation upon the minority to submit to the choice of the majority? And whence do the 100 who want a master get the right to vote for the 10 who do not so wish? The law of plurality voting is itself an establishment of convention and assumes unanimity, at least on one occasion. Chapter 6 of the Social Compact. I assume that men have reached a point where the obstacles injurious to their preservation in the state of nature overwhelm the forces that each individual can employ to maintain himself in this state. Then this primitive state can no longer subsist, and mankind would perish if it did not change its way of life. Now, since men cannot engender new forces, but only unite and direct those that exist, they no longer have any other means to preserve themselves than to form, by aggregation, a sum of forces that can prevail over those obstacles, to bring these forces into play by a single motive power, and to make them act in concert. The sum of forces can arise only from the coming together of several men. But the force and the freedom of each man being the original instruments of his preservation, how will he commit them without injuring himself and without neglecting the cares that he owes himself? This difficulty, leading back to my subject, may be expressed in these terms. To find a form of association which defends and protects the person and goods of each associate with all the common force, and in which each uniting with all nevertheless obeys only himself and remains as free as before. Such is the fundamental problem to which the social contract gives the solution. The clauses of this contract are so determined by the nature of the act that the least modification would render them null and void. They are such that, even though they may perhaps never have been formally expressed, they are everywhere the same, everywhere tacitly admitted and recognized. But when the social compact is violated, each associate resumes his original rights and retakes his natural freedom, while losing the conventional freedom for which he renounced natural freedom. These clauses, properly understood, all reduce to one, namely the total alienation of each associate with all his rights to the whole community. Because, in the first place, each giving himself completely, the situation is the same for all. And the situation being the same for all, it is in no one's interest to make it onerous for others. Moreover, the alienation being done without reservation, the union is as perfect as it can be, and no associate any longer has anything to demand back. For if some rights were left to individuals where there were no common superior to decide between them and the public, each individual being his own judge in some cases would soon claim to be it for all. The state of nature would subsist, and the association would necessarily become tyrannical or useless. Finally, each giving himself to all gives himself to no one, and since there is no associate over whom he does not acquire the same right that he yields over himself, he gains the equivalent of all that he loses and more force to preserve that which he has. If then one removes from the social compact that which is not its essence, one will find that it is reduced to the following terms. Each of us places in common his person and all his power under the supreme direction of the general will, as we as a body receive each member as an individual part of the whole. At once, in place of the particular person of each contractor, this act of association produces a moral and collective body, composed of as many members as there are voices in the assembly. And by this same act, the body receives its unity, its common I, its life, and its will. In other times, this public person so formed by the union of all others took the name city, and now takes that of republic or body politic, which is called by its members state, when it is passive, sovereign, when it is active, power in comparison to others like itself. Note,
the true sense of this word has been almost entirely obliterated among the moderns. Most take a town for a city and a bourgeois for a citizen. They do not know that houses make a town, but that citizens make a city. In another time, the same mistake cost the Carthaginians dearly. I have not read of the title Cives ever having been given to the subjects of any prince. Not in antiquity to the Macedonians, nor in our day to the English, despite their being closer to freedom than all the others. Only the French, with great familiarity, take on the name of citizens, because they have no true idea of it, as one can see in their dictionaries. Otherwise, in usurping it, they would fall into the crime of lèse majesté. Among them, this name expresses a virtue and not a right. When Baudin wanted to speak of our citizens and bourgeois, he made the gross blunder of taking the one for the other. Monsieur d'Alembert did not make the same mistake, and in his article on Geneva, has properly distinguished the four orders of men, or five counting ordinary foreigners, who are in our town, and of which only two compose the Republic. No other French author that I know has understood the true sense of the word citizen.
In regard to the associates, they take collectively the name people and call themselves individually citizens as participants in the sovereign authority, and subjects as being under the laws of the state. But these terms are often confused and are taken one for another. It suffices to know how to distinguish them when they are used in all their precision. Chapter 7 Of the Sovereign. This formula shows that the act of association contains a reciprocal commitment between the public and the individuals, and that each individual, contracting as it were with himself, is doubly committed, as a member of the sovereign to individuals and as a member of the state to the sovereign. But the maxim of civil right, that no one is bound by commitments made with himself, cannot be applied here, for there is a great difference between making an obligation with oneself and with the whole of which one is part. It is necessary to note further that public deliberation, which, due to the two different relations under which each of the subjects is seen, can obligate all to the sovereign, cannot, by the opposite reason, obligate the sovereign to itself. And consequently, it is against the nature of the body politic for the sovereign to impose a law on itself which it could not break. Only being able to consider itself as under one and the same relation, the sovereign is then a case of an individual contracting with himself. From this it appears that there neither is nor can be any kind of fundamental law obligatory upon the body of people, not even a social contract. This does not mean that this body cannot very well commit itself with others in matters that do not derogate from this contract, for in regard to the foreigner it becomes a simple being, an individual. But the body politic or the sovereign, drawing its existence only from the sanctity of the contract, can never, even towards others, obligate itself to anything that derogates from the original act, such as alienating some portion of itself or submitting to another sovereign. To violate the act by which it exists would be to annihilate itself. That which is nothing can produce nothing. As soon as this multitude is thus united in one body, one of the members cannot be injured without attacking the body, much less the body be injured without the members feeling it. Thus, duty and interest equally obligate the two contracting parties mutually to aid each other, and the same men should seek to bring together under this dual relationship all the advantages that depend on it. Now, the sovereign, being formed only of the individuals who compose it, neither has nor can have any interest contrary to theirs. Consequently, the sovereign power has no need to give guarantees to its subjects, because it is impossible that the body should want to harm all its members, and we shall presently see that it can do no harm to anyone in particular. The sovereign, solely because of what it is always all that it should be. But it is not so with the subject's relation to the sovereign. Despite the common interest, nothing would vouch for their commitments if the sovereign did not find means of assuring their fidelity. In fact, each individual may, as a man, have a particular will contrary or dissimilar to the general will which he has as a citizen. His particular interest may speak to him quite differently than the common interest. His existence, absolutely and naturally independent, may make him regard what he owes to the common cause as a gratuitous contribution, the loss of which will be less harmful to others than the payment is onerous to himself. And considering the moral person who constitutes the state as an imaginary being because it is not a man, he would enjoy the rights of the citizen without wishing to fulfill the duties of the subject. The progress of this injustice would cause the ruin of the body politic. In order, then, that the social compact not be an empty formula, it tacitly contains this commitment which alone can give force to the others, that whoever shall refuse to obey the general will shall be constrained to do so by the whole body. This means nothing other than that he will be forced to be free, because this is the condition which, giving each citizen to the fatherland, guarantees him from all personal dependence, the condition which designs and activates the political machine, and which alone renders civil commitments legitimate. Without it, they would be absurd, tyrannical, and subject to the most enormous abuses. Chapter 8 Of the Civil State. This passage from the state of nature to the civil state produces in man a very remarkable change. By substituting justice for instinct in his conduct, and giving morality to his actions which they previously lacked. It is only then that the voice of duty taking the place of physical impulse and right to the place of appetite, man, who until then had only thought of himself, finds himself forced to act on other principles and to consult his reason before listening to his inclinations. Although in this state he is deprived of several advantages that he gets from nature, he gains in it others so great, his faculties are exercised and developed, his ideas are extended, his sentiments are ennobled, his entire soul is raised to such a peak, that even if the abuses of this new condition were often to degrade him below that which he left, he ought to bless ceaselessly the happy moment that tore him from it forever, and which, from a stupid and limited animal, made an intelligent being and a man. Let us reduce this balance to terms easily compared. What man loses by the social contract is his natural freedom and an unlimited right to all that tempts him and that he can attain. What he gains is civil freedom and property and all that he possesses. In order not to be mistaken concerning these compensations, it is necessary carefully to distinguish natural freedom, which is bounded only by the forces of the individual, from civil freedom, which is limited by the general will, and possession, which is only the effect of force or the right of the first occupant, and property, which can only be founded upon a positive title. One might add to the preceding that the moral freedom is also acquired in the civil state, and it alone truly makes a man master of himself. For the impulse of mere appetite is slavery, and to obey law which one has prescribed for oneself is freedom. But I have already said too much on this matter, and the philosophical sense of the word freedom is no part of my subject here. Chapter 9. Of Real Property. At the moment that the community is founded, each member gives himself to it just as he is, he and all his forces, which include the goods that he possesses. It is not that by this act possession changes its nature by changing hands and becomes property in the hands of the sovereign. But as the forces of the city are incomparably greater than those of an individual, public possession is also in fact stronger and more irrevocable, without being more legitimate, at least for foreigners. For the state, in respect to its members, is master of all their goods by the social contract, which serves as the basis of all rights of the state. But from the perspective of other powers, it is only the right of the first occupant which the state obtains from individuals. The right of the first occupant, though more real than that of the stronger, becomes a true right only after the establishment of the right of property. Every man, naturally, has the right to everything that is necessary to him, but the positive act which makes him proprietor of some good excludes him from all the rest. His part being settled, he ought to limit himself to it, and no longer has any claim on the community. This is why the right of the first occupant, so weak in the state of nature, is respected by every civil man. By this right, one respects less what belongs to others than what does not belong to oneself. In general, to authorize the right of the first occupant over any piece of land, the following conditions are necessary. First, that this piece of land not yet be inhabited by anyone. Second, that one only occupy as much as one needs for subsistence. And in the third place, that one take possession of it not by an empty ceremony, but by work and cultivation, the sole sign of property which, in the absence of juridical title, should be respected by others. In resting the right of the first occupant upon need and work, is that not in fact extending it as far as it can go? Can some limits not be given to this right? Will it be enough to set foot on a piece of common land to allege that at that moment one becomes master of it? Will it be enough to have the momentary force to separate other men from it in order to deprive them of the right of ever returning? How can a man or a people seize an immense territory and deprive mankind of it except by a punishable usurpation, since the rest of men are thereby deprived of a place of residence and sustenance, which nature gives men in common? When Nunez Balboa, standing on the shore, took possession of the South Sea and all South America in the name of the Crown of Castile, was this enough to dispossess all the inhabitants and to exclude all the princes of the world from it? On this basis, such ceremonies would proliferate endlessly, and the Catholic king from his chamber might have taken possession of the whole universe, afterwards only cutting from this empire what other princes already possessed. One can see how the united and contiguous lands of individuals become the public territory, and how the right of sovereignty, extending from the subjects to the terrain that they occupy, becomes both real and personal, for it places the possessors in the greatest dependence and makes of their very forces the guarantees of their fidelity. This advantage does not appear to have been grasped by the ancient monarchs who called themselves kings of the Persians, the Scythians, of the Macedonians, seeming to regard themselves as the rulers of men rather than as masters of the country. Those of today more cleverly call themselves kings of France, of Spain, of England, etc., and thus holding the land they are very sure of holding its inhabitants. What is singular in this alienation is that in accepting the goods of individuals, the community is far from despoiling them of them. It only serves to assure individuals of legitimate possession of their goods, changing usurpation into a true right and possession into property. Then the possessors being considered as depositories of the public good, their rights being respected by all members of the state and maintained by all its forces against the foreigner, by a cessation advantageous to the public and more so to themselves, they have, so to speak, acquired all that they have given up. This is a paradox easily explained by the distinction between the rights which the sovereign and the proprietor have over the same basic object, as will be seen hereafter. It may also happen that men begin to unite before possessing anything, and that subsequently seizing a terrain sufficient for all, they enjoy it in common, or they divide it amongst themselves, equally or in the proportions established by the sovereign. However this acquisition is made, the right that each individual has over his own part is always subordinate to the right of the community overall, without which there would be neither solidity of the social bond nor real force in the exercise of sovereignty. I shall end this chapter and this book with a remark which may serve as the basis of the whole social system. The fundamental compact, instead of destroying natural equality, substitutes a moral and legitimate equality for that physical inequality which nature had set up among men. And men, however unequal in force and genius, all became equal by convention and right. Note:
under bad governments, this equality is only apparent and illusory. It serves only to maintain the poor in their misery and the rich in their usurpation. In fact, the laws are always useful to those who possess and harmful to those who have nothing, from which it follows that the social state is advantageous to men only when they all have something and no one has too much.
End of the first book.
Thank you for listening to this sample. To continue listening to this book and for access to all of our other full audiobooks, please subscribe for $7.77 per month. Go to adultbrain.ca or follow the link in the show notes. This will be a completely separate podcast with a new RSS feed and will have all the titles from this feed as well. Thank you for your help and support in bringing rare and forgotten books to audio for the world.